When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 456th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's Awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most talented and, frankly, ballsiest filmmakers of our time. The most famous living New Zealander, he is a writer, director, and producer whose films, many made in collaboration with his life partner, Fran Walsh, include 1994's Heavenly Creatures, the landmark Lord of the Rings trilogy spanning 2001 through 2003, the 2005 remake of King Kong, the Hobbit trilogy spanning 2012 through 2014, the feature-length 2018 documentary They Shall Not Grow Old, and most recently, the 2022 Disney Plus documentary series The Beatles Get Back, which draws upon 57 hours of footage and 140 hours of audio, most of it never before seen or heard, to chronicle the 22 days leading up to the Fab Four's final public performance in January of 1969. A nominee for 9 Oscars, 3 of which resulted in wins, and the winner of 4 BAFTA Awards, a Critics' Choice Award, a Golden Globe Award, a Directors Guild Award, and 2 Producers Guild Awards, he is now nominated for an Emmy for Best Directing for a Documentary or Nonfiction Program for The Beatles' Get Back, which itself is nominated for Best Documentary or Nonfiction Series. Sir Peter Jackson. Over the course of our conversation, the 60-year-old and I discussed how a kid from Wellington fell in love with the movies and began making films of his own, many from the earliest days with a focus on visual effects. How a filmmaker who broke into the business making splatter horror films and whose only studio film before The Lord of the Rings had been a box office flop came to be entrusted with that project's not one but 3 very expensive films. Why he has, in recent years, somewhat lost his desire to make narrative films and has instead gravitated toward documentaries, which require him to pore over and restore archival footage that most people have never seen before, what he makes of the current state of the film industry, and of Amazon's upcoming nearly half-billion-dollar TV version of The Lord of the Rings, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Peter, thank you so much for doing the podcast. Great to have you, and really enjoyed the Beatles docuseries, which we're going to come to. But first on this podcast, we truly go back to the very beginning. Can I ask you to share with anyone who may not know, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in Wellington, New Zealand. And my folks were, I was an only child. So my mum and dad were... Dad worked in the local city council. He was a paymaster, used to pay the council employees their wages each week. So it was like a sort of civil servant, really. Mum used to work at mending hosiery, women's hosiery. And then she obviously brought me up for a while. Then when I was a teenager, she was able to go back to work again. And it was a very nice, simple upbringing, nothing complicated. Nothing awful. They were very, very sweet parents.
Yeah.
Neither of them were particularly film orientated. They didn't, you know, when I started to develop an interest in movies and grabbed their Super 8 camera, which they had got for home movies, you know, just for making family holidays and things, and I started shooting, models with it and monsters and things, they didn't quite know what to think. But... it was a good lesson because it was two parents who had no affinity for what their son wanted to do, but they were 100% supportive the entire time.
Well, and I did gather from some of the prep I did that really, I guess it was a fateful thing. The fact that they received as a Christmas gift this camera, which you then commandeered. But I mean, a few things, right? It wasn't just that. It was that you happened to watch on TV some films that really shaped your interest, not just in filmmaking, but special effects in particular, right?
Yeah, well, I never thought about being a filmmaker like as you'd think about a director or a writer or anything, particularly because that, I mean, I didn't even understand what that was. When I'm, you know, we're talking about when I'm 7 or 8, 9 years old. But they did get a Super 8 camera for Christmas from a friend of theirs down the road, worked for Kodak. And Kodak had put the most simple, basic box camera together that they could sell to sort of anybody for taking home movies. And so my auntie who lived down the road gave my mum and dad one of those for Christmas, and I immediately grabbed it. And because I'd already started making models and things and monsters, and I thought, oh, I could actually use this camera and that model I made, and I could connect the two together. And a lot of that came from Gerry Anderson TV shows that in New Zealand in the we were talking about the early 60s, really. You know, Thunderbirds, Stingray, Captain Scarlet, those were as big as it got. They were huge, and so I was I set about making copies of the models, and then when this camera arrived in the house, it made me realize that the Thunderbirds that I was watching on TV were sort of models, and they were being filmed. And now that this camera arrived, I could film mine as well. So I was just sort of, it all just came together really in a stumbly, ad hoc kind of way.
Well, and it seems like by the time you were, I guess, about 15, you were committed enough to this that not only do you have a film in a school competition, but that film, I believe, is on television. You're thinking already time to maybe leave school a little early and focus on this. But, you know, being in New Zealand, what were your models of what that would even look like?
Nothing really. I mean, during that sort of 8-9 year period to sort of being 15, it was I started to have ambitions to work in film, but I also saw King Kong on TV, the original Willis O'Brien, you know, King Kong, and that was when I was about 8 or 9 or 10 or something, and that movie, more than Thunderbirds in a way, that movie really nailed me. I just thought it was the most incredible thing that I'd ever seen. Going to a forgotten island and encountering dinosaurs and a large gorilla, I just thought this is as good as it gets. And so I started to learn, or at least understand, about stop motion animation, and because I was an only child, and I lived in a very small town. There was only about 500 people in the town I was in. It wasn't like I was part of a big social group or anything. So I started to gravitate towards stop motion as a career, because I thought, well, that's something, right, you know. And obviously Ray Harryhausen was a big influence too, because Willis O'Brien was, I think he probably passed away by that stage, but Ray was still making films, and I was reading every article I could find, which was not much, because it was pre-internet. And so I started to gravitate to the idea of being a stop-motion animator, but simply because it was a solitary thing that you could do. And it produced the films that I loved. I mean, the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, what a great movie. That Cyclops is my favorite all-time monster. So, and because all the photographs that I could find showed Ray Harryhausen all by himself, bending over a table with a model, I thought, well, that is something I can do. Because obviously I was aware that films had huge crews and lots of budgets and famous film stars, and all that was just way too much for me to even think about. But to go back to your question, the New Zealand film industry didn't really exist. I mean, obviously the film industry existed, but we didn't make feature films, and it wasn't until 1976 that the first feature films that New Zealand had made in quite some time appeared, and it was Roger Donaldson with Smash Palace, and Jeff Murphy made a film called Sleeping Dogs. And so, you know, having been having this ambition for several years to be a filmmaker in a country that didn't actually make films was kind of strange. But then, as I say, about 1975, 76, when I was 15, 16 years old, New Zealand finally started to make films.
Now, what I think people who look at your filmography may not appreciate, they see that probably the first directorial credit as Bad Taste comes out in 87. But that was actually, for reasons which I hope I can ask you to explain, that was a four-year endeavor during which most of your time was actually spent at a newspaper office, I believe. So why was – and you're living at home. Can you explain the sacrifices that you and I guess your parents had to make to allow you to at least show that you were worthy of a full-time career as a filmmaker?
Well, I mean, even though Roger and Jeff Murphy had started to make films, there wasn't really an industry that hired young people particularly. You know, that it was still a rare occasion for New Zealand to make a feature film for the next few years. And so it wasn't like, you know, that those movies appearing on the scene suddenly created a whole range of job opportunities. That just didn't really happen. So to me, filmmaking was something I was going to do, whether I was doing it for somebody else or me or whatever. I just loved it. So, and for me, in my mind, it became all about money, not money to earn, but money to spend, because I'd been working on the Super 8 movies for several years. And so when I'm now about 15 years old, I guess. And my parents wanted me to go to university, you know, and they wanted me to be an architect, and that's where their hearts were and all of this. And what I wanted to do was to earn money somewhere, anywhere. I mean, I had no concept of getting a job in the film industry. It didn't really exist. But I knew I wanted to get a 16mm camera because I was spending an awful lot of time on my 8mm movies. And in the back of my mind, I thought, well, I'm wasting my time because 8mm, you never can't really screen it anywhere. It's not going to ever do a thing. So I was on a road to nowhere, if you like. So I just said to my parents, look, I know you want me to go to university for another 3, 4, 5 years. I said, I just want to leave school, get a job, and actually save up to buy a 16mm camera. In fact, there was a shop in town, a secondhand camera store that had a 16mm camera for $2,500 that I used to go and just stare at it for ages and ages. So I even had the camera locked up. So that night we looked at the newspaper, the job advertisements in the newspaper, and there was a job for something called a photo engraver, which I hadn't got a clue what a photo engraver was, but at least it had the word photo in the title. So I went for an interview, and it turned out to be the local newspaper, and it was a photo engraving apprenticeship. So I got that job, if you like it, and it was an apprenticeship, and I was there for 7 years. I think the apprenticeship was 4 years. I mean, when I signed up, I had to sign up for 4 years to complete the apprenticeship, and then I ended up staying on for three more years so I could earn money to pay for this film that I started. So after about 2 years, I'd saved up enough money to buy the 16mm camera, you know, and I was working at the newspaper. Now, when I got the 16mm camera, I had inherited another problem for myself because the film stock was so expensive. I sort of knew on it was going to be more expensive than Super 8, but it was like 4 or 5 times more expensive. And so I could literally, you know, to put 3 minutes of film through that camera, I would have to save up money from my photo engraving job for about a month. And then after a month, I could buy a 3-minute roll of film. I remember I was getting paid $75 a week was my salary, and to get a roll of 16mm film, get it processed, developed, and printed, it was about $37-38 at the time. So, you take that off my weekly pay, and it's like there isn't anything left. So anyway, I thought I got the camera. I hadn't filmed a single frame of film, but I had the camera. Then I saved up and I bought a few rolls of film. And I thought, well, I need to learn how to use 16mm. I need to actually figure this out because there's no film schools or anything. I didn't know anybody that could teach me. I got to figure this thing. It's got a whole lot more buttons than the little Kodak box camera had. It's got all sorts of things that I hadn't got a clue about. So, but given the cost of the film stock, I just thought I can't waste it. So I got a few of my friends from the photo engraving department. You know, we had about 15 or 20 guys that we were working with. No girls. It was all blokes. I dreamt up a little storyline, which would be like a little 10-minute short film. I saved up for 3 or 4 rolls of film, which I thought would, you know, cover the 10 minutes. I asked my friends at work if they'd come and help me on a Sunday to shoot this thing. And they said, yeah, sure, sure. And they weren't interested in films particularly. These guys are, they're interested in soccer and girls and cars and that thing. And so I started shooting that film. And just to cut the long story short, the problem was that I'd film on a Sunday and be quite happy with what I had shot. And then I had a whole week, because I hadn't quite finished. I had to do some more, but I had a whole week being a photo engraver now, where I was sitting there doing my photo engraving work, thinking up new ideas for this film. So come the next Sunday, it was finishing off what we did last Sunday, but now I've got some more ideas that we could do some more stuff. And so this thing just grew over 4 years, basically. It became a feature film. Weekly increments, it slowly became a feature film. And it wasn't really 4 years like every Sunday we went out and shoot, because it was a situation where I had to stop shooting because I couldn't afford the film anymore. And so I got into a situation where I would save up, buy four rolls of 16 mil. And we're talking about a roll being about a 3 or 4 minutes, a 50-foot roll. Were they hundreds? I can't remember. Anyway, so I would get the guys together on a Sunday. I'd go and shoot whatever the scenes were that I had figured out, and it was 16 mil neg. But then I realised I couldn't afford to actually process the neg. I'd spent all my money on buying the film stock, but I couldn't actually get it developed, let alone a print. So what I do then is I put the film rolls in the fridge at home. And I couldn't do any more filming for a month because I was now officially saving up to process those four rolls. And that only gives you a process neg, because I also had to pay another big chunk of money to get a print made that I could actually watch. So it was a stop-start process over 4 years. The New Zealand Film Commission finally got to see a version of what I'd done towards the last 3 or 4 months, and they agreed to put money into finance the post-production, meaning that we could get a composer, we could do a neg cut, do a color grade, and it actually went to the Cannes Film Festival in 1987, and it sold well. The New Zealand Film Commission had the sales rights to it, and I think they sold it to 50 countries within the first 24 hours or something. So
yeah, suddenly there's no more engraving for you.
No.
Well, now also, is it correct that it's got to be around that time that you meet somebody named Fran Walsh?
Yep. The first time I met Fran is that I had about a 90-minute version of Bad Taste. I still hadn't got the climax shot, and I had met a guy who was in the film industry, sort of in the peripheral. So he was a third AD, and I said to him, "Oh, could you have a look at this film that I've been shooting?" Because I didn't know whether it was any good or not. And you're a third AD; you obviously know your stuff. He was the same sort of age as me, and so we arranged a time that he'd show up, and I'd have my projector there with my great big roll of cut film, and he brought along a couple of friends of his, one of which was Fran Walsh, who he'd met as a writer. She was working in TV. And so she came along to look at an early cut of Bad Taste, give me some thoughts. I think within 2 or 3 weeks, I gave her a paintbrush, and she was painting sets, because I still had the climax to do. So I got her involved in set building. And did anybody that ran across me in those days was engaged to do something like that. I had to blow up a car. Sort of a rocket launcher as a car, and so I had a couple of mates who knew a little bit about explosives, knew a tiny little bit about explosives. So I said, "Oh, could you come along and blow up this car for me?" "Oh, yeah." And I realized in hindsight they didn't really have a clue, but it was a big explosion, that's for sure. So I met Fran then, and we're still at it now.
Well, and I know you've said in other interviews that I read to prep for this, I guess it was a couple of years of really just being good friends before it became life partners, which is probably the best way to do these things, right?
Yes, it is. No. Fran and I became buddies over about two or three years before anything happened.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, I guess obviously these first several years that you're in the business after the first film that we've just been talking about, there's Meet the Feebles in 89, Brain Dead in 92. Sort of, it seems like you were heading in the direction of comedic horror, I guess it might be fair to say. was that because that allowed you to employ this, to apply this interest in special effects, visual effects, or was that actually just the, would that have been your path anyway?
It's a good question. I've always been attracted to movies that are larger than life. You know, I mean, Hitchcock quote that I love, some people's films are slices of life, mine are slices of cake. That's been my philosophy. So I've always, you know, so, you know, other people were watching Truffaut and Bergman films and everything. And I was watching The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad when I was that sort of that age. You know, they were the films that I liked. So there was a bit of that. I loved the fact that films could show you things and take you places that you were never going to go in your real life. So certainly it's always been from since the day I saw Thunderbirds on TV as a 5-year-old or King Kong as an 8-year-old. That's always been the thing that's attracted me. But however, what I would also say is that there were two other things going on at the time. Is that this is 1987 maybe now, 88, and you're right at the height of that great splatter period with Sam Raimi. I think he had just done Evil Dead 2. George Romero, the Dawn of the Dead was the most awesome film that I'd ever seen in my life at that point. The Reanimator, Stuart Gordon, you know, so I was just loving these movies, and so it's not... To me, it's not anything strange about that. That was the direction that I was heading, because those were the films I loved. But also, what I would say is that when you're, you know, young like that, starting out, you've got no money, zero budget. And so, to me, a horror movie, you know, a splatter movie, whatever you want to call it, is a good way to get some experience, because you can do a lot in a horror movie for not much money, and yet you can still achieve a reaction from the audience. You know, if you're trying to do a rom-com, then you're going to need a really witty script, and you're going to need some actors that can perform it really well. You know, so you don't go the rom-com way, you go the horror film way, because that's much easier to get an impact in the horror film genre when you have very limited resources than it is in a more sophisticated form of film,
yeah,
if you like.
Well, I find it interesting, though, that, you know, people, you're very associated with Weta, which people know as the VFX, house that you started in 93. But yes. I find it interesting that was basically right ahead of maybe one of the less VFX-centric projects that you did, which was Heavenly Creatures. I know there's some of that there, but this is maybe, would it be fair to say this is one of the first times where you're really, it's performance-centric or actor-centric as much as anything. This is, just to remind people, a film about a infamous crime in New Zealand, but you discovered essentially Melanie Lynskey and Kate Winslet to play these two sisters who are at the center of it. Pretty good eye for talent, I would say. And then, you know, in terms of the writing of it, I know that you had said, you know, you co-wrote this with Fran. You said, quote, probably the greatest fun we've ever had working on a script, close quote. So I guess I just wonder, why is Weta coming along just at about the same time as Heavenly Creatures?
I mean, what Fran deserves a huge credit for I'd been sort of 10 or 12 years doing stop motion, you know, in limited ways with Super 8, then 16, and then doing horror films and stuff. But and in a way, I hadn't really thought much about writing, you know, during that early time, because it was that the writing part of it. I figured somebody else eventually does that. They write a monster, and if I'm lucky, I'm going to have a career where I get to animate the monster that somebody else has written about. So that's where I was sort of heading. And then I met Fran, and she started to talk to me about scripts, and she co-wrote the second and third films I made, Meet the Feebles and Brain Dead. And then while we were working on what we used to do in those days, is that because our world in New Zealand was that the New Zealand Film Commission would put funding into a film, and then they always had a pattern really where they'd take it to the Cannes Film Festival and become the sales agents for it, or maybe they did it in Venice sometimes too, but generally it was Cannes. And so we got into the swing of the idea that if you've just made a film that's got Film Commission money, they're going to take it to Cannes. We're going to get to go to Cannes and do a junket and stuff. But have your next script ready to go, because you know, because if the film that you've just made gets some interest at Cannes, you want to be able to say to whoever you're talking to, it's normally a foreign sales agent, Bob, by the way, we have our next film already written. So we got into the habit of don't take the last film to Cannes until, you know, if you don't have the script for the next one, because otherwise you're not able to capitalize on the moment. So Fran said to me while we were working on Braindead, she said to me, have you ever heard of the Parker Hume murder? And I hadn't. Turned out to be one of New Zealand's most famous murders. And Fran had had an interest in it for quite a long time, and she started to talk to me about it. And so the two of us decided it would make an interesting film. And it was nothing to do with the fact, oh, let's get into a different genre, let's move on from the splatter films. It was just simply she talked to me about the story of these two girls, and we thought it would make a great film. So she and I went down to Christchurch, which is in the South Island, where the events happened. And fortunately, we got there in about 1992, so we got there about 38 years after the events happened. And so there was still a lot of people alive that were very intimately involved. I mean, I'm sure they're just about all dead now. And there was a lot of the locations that things took place were still intact in Christchurch. So we really had a great time researching and interviewing people that were classmates of these two girls, interviewing the policemen that arrested them, all sorts of people. And that's why it was, in many respects, the greatest scriptwriting experience, because it was like a true story that we were immersing ourselves by talking to the people that were involved in it. It is certainly a film where I got to think about movie making outside of just grossing people out with cheap little effects. But we cast, just to talk about the casting for a moment, we cast, just to show how random life is, we cast Kate Winslet out of the UK. You know, she was the first one, and we knew that she was going to be a big star. She hadn't done a film then. I think she'd been in a British TV sort of series, a medical series. You know, it was a BBC thing, but she hadn't done any movies. So we got Kate. So we had one of the two girls. Both of the two girls had to be sort of equally powerful in a different kind of way. And Kate was playing the English girl, Juliet Hume, and we had to find a New Zealand girl who was a very different personality. And we auditioned and auditioned and auditioned and couldn't find anybody. This sounds crazy, but it's true. We were about 2 or 3 weeks out from the first day of the shoot, and we still hadn't cast, the other girl, Pauline Parker, her name was in the True Life story. And then it got down to 2 weeks. Then it got down to 10 days before we were going to start shooting, and we had nobody. And I remember Fran just saying, I distinctly remember it just saying, this is insane. We've spent so much time on this, and now we're 2 weeks out and we haven't got our Pauline Parker. So she got in a car and she started to drive from town to town. And she would phone the school, whatever the local school was in the town coming up. She would phone them up and say, "Hi, I'm working on a film. We're casting we want a 15-year-old girl, sort of a dark hair. Acting experience not really important, but because we can certainly work with them, but they have to have a presence." And she would arrive at the school about, you know, an hour later, our phone call, she'd arrive at the school, they'd have the kids lined up for her to inspect, and she went through 2 or 3 schools, and then she arrived at New Plymouth Girls High School. There's a town called New Plymouth, and the teacher had got the phone call an hour or two ahead of time. The teacher had plucked out 2 or 3 girls from the drama class who she thought might be worthy, and these girls were in the front row, and Fran looked at them, said hi, and had a chat to them. And then at the back of the classroom there was this young 15-year-old girl who just sat there, didn't say a thing, and didn't appear to be engaged that much. And Fran said, "Who's she?" And they said, "Oh, that's a girl called Mel." And Fran said, "Could I have a talk with Mel?" And she took Mel out into the corridor, and she said, "Are you interested in being in a film?" And she spoke to her. And then within a day or two, Fran met her parents at that trip, and within a day or two, she had joined us on set. I mean, it was literally Fran standing in the classroom saying, and who's that girl at the back that started Mel's entire career going? I mean, it's just
unbelievable. And now you both are going to the Emmys as nominees this year after many other great accomplishments. But and we'll say that, of course, with Heavenly Creatures, won prizes at Venice and Toronto, grossed $12 million worldwide, and the first Oscar nomination for both you and Fran for original screenplay. But I wonder, after that, when I imagine now you're more on the radar of the international film industry than ever before, you made your first studio film, The Frighteners, in 96, is with Michael J. Fox. A decent amount of effects shots there. I think Zemeckis as the EP on that one. Cost $38 million. There's a big first time you're really dealing with a project of large scale. Were you at home immediately with that kind of a thing, or was that a big jump?
The budget is not so much of a jump as you think. I mean, Heavenly Creatures crossed $2.5 million US, I think. So it is certainly, number wise, it's a jump. But at the end of the day, as a director, you're just showing up on set, figuring out what lens to use, where to put the camera, and it makes it a little bit easier. Like in the early films, a Steadicam, having a Steadicam on set was an expensive thing. So I used to have to go through the script of Bad Taste. I mean, Heavenly Creatures, it was like, I'd be told, well, you can afford a Steadicam on 6 days of the 45-day shoot or whatever it was. So can you go through the schedule, Peter, and just pick the 6 days that you'd like to have a Steadicam? I mean, that was what it was like. And then when the Frighteners came along, it was like we had a Steadicam in the truck all every single day. So there was perks like that. But I didn't really answer the weather question. What happened concurrently with us making Heavenly Creatures, which had, in theory, it had some sort of little morphing-y type sort of effects, not anything particularly remarkable, but just to show this imaginative world that the girls were inventing. And that coincided exactly with Jurassic Park coming out. While we're probably in post-production on Heavenly Creatures, Fran and I go and see Jurassic Park, and it's like, oh, my God. The Tyrannosaurus is like, it's so real because I was just a stop motion guy up to then. And then at that point, we knew that computers, CGI, and these are words that I didn't even really understand at all at the time. Computers, CGI were going to be the way of the future. I mean, we see Terminator 2 as well, but that was because it was a silvery guy. I didn't understand how far CGI could go. I mean, sure, if we can do silvery metal people, that's fine. But a T-Rex with all its skin texture and its muscles and its breathing, it just blew my mind. And at that point, the world became very simple. That if I want to carry on making films that have visual effects, the type of films I like, I'd better start learning about these computers, because it seems like suddenly the old world is becoming something very new very quickly. And so Heavenly Creatures didn't need any CGI of any description, really. We could have done it various ways. But we did have a couple of sequences that we thought, well, if we get a computer, we could at least just do a few of these shots for Heavenly Creatures, and at least we'll be learning what the computer. So we bought one Silicon Graphics computer ourselves. I can't remember what it cost, 35 grand or something. And it was a Silicon Graphics Indigo computer, I remember. And we hired one person that actually knew what buttons to press. And so we did some really, and today they look pretty crude, but we did about 20 or 30, CGI shots for Heavenly Creatures, which were literally only there so we could learn how these computers worked, because we knew that was going to be the future. And then after Heavenly Creatures was finished, we still only had one computer. But we met Bob Zemeckis I can't remember how we met Bob now, but he was producing a television series called Tales from the Crypt, a 30-minute anthology series. And he said, I think he saw Heavenly Creatures and liked it, and we happened to be in LA passing through, and he met with us, and he said, hey, have you guys got any ideas? Like, I'm doing a Tales from the Crypt show, it can be anything you want, anything spooky. So Fran and I got home, we went, had a walk to the shops, because we needed to buy some milk or cheese or something, and we sort of talked about the whole Frighteners plot on the way to the shop, that a fake psychic guy you know, seems to be scamming people, but it turns out that he's actually is a real psychic guy, but he's still scamming people. We just sort of came up with this silly plot, and so we pitched it to Bob for the Tales from the Crypt, and he said, oh, I like it a lot, but it doesn't feel like a TV episode to me. It feels like a film. I'll produce it as a film. You guys write and you can direct it. I'll produce it. Let's just do a film. And so we wrote the script, did the movie. Bob was fantastic. Bob in a way, I mean, it was shot in New Zealand, so it wasn't really a big opening the door to Hollywood in my mind so much. So I could stay in my comfort zone. We could still work in the same town. We could still work with the same crews that we'd worked with the same people. But Bob was fantastic. He really held my hand during the more Hollywood aspects of that. I always remember, it was one thing I'm always very grateful for Bob for, although people could argue that it's a lesson that I've forgotten over the years. I just thought with someone like Bob Zemeckis, you know, the whole idea of a big 800-pound gorilla was that whenever you got into trouble, you just turn to Bob and say, Bob, we're falling behind schedule, we're falling behind budget. Can you talk to the studio and get us some more money? I thought that's how it kind of worked, you see. So, and we were trying to stick to budget as much as possible. But I remember there was a moment when we had a big chase scene that we were coming up to shoot. We had been shooting for seven, eight weeks, and yet we were falling a little bit behind budget, and so we were not. And this big chase scene was coming up, And it was clear that if we shot the chase and all that, we were going to be out of money by the time we finished shooting. And so I said to Bob, I think we're going to be about, you know, $4 or $5 million short, Bob. You know, thinking I was expecting him to say, I'll get that for you, Peter. Don't worry. But he didn't say that. He said the best thing that he could have said. He said, $4 or $5 million, eh? So what are you going to do about it, Pete? What are you going to do about that? And to this day, I'm grateful for Bob saying that to me. It wasn't like, I'm your guardian angel, I'll go shake up the universal tree and we'll get some more money. It was like he swung it straight back on me. You can't be $5 million over budget, Peter. So how are you going to deal with that? So I went home that night and I cut out the big chase scene. And I took it in the next day, and he looked at it and he said, "Yep, this is a good save. Good save." Yeah, as I say, people could argue that it's a lesson I've forgotten since then, but I appreciated that at the time.
Well, I guess in a way, though, the greatest legacy in a way of the Frighteners may be the fact that you now own several computers that, as long as you have them, what are you going to do to make use of them, right?
Yeah, well, the Frighteners, you know, the script sort of came, because the script idea wasn't ambitious at the beginning because it was for a 30-minute TV episode, but then once it became a feature film and as part of the whole budgeting process at the beginning of it, we realized one computer wasn't going to get these shots done. It was about 500 CGI shots maybe in the Frighteners, and we ended up with 37 computers. 30, which is sort of 37 or 40 crew members as well. So the whole CGI thing of that got amped right up hugely. But it was also terrifying because, you know, you get into a spiral, I guess. It's like, okay, well, we've got 37 computers, we've got 40 people on the payroll. Now, when we get the Frighteners finished, what's going to happen? We can't afford to pay 40 people with no income. I mean we'd had no money at all. We're, you know, mortgaged our houses at this point for all the earlier stuff. We had no money. So you realize you built something, but it's like an albatross. It's not all that much fun. And so after the Frighteners, we were really stuck because we had a infrastructure that was costing us money. We were paying these wages now. Once the film stopped paying, and then because the shots had been finished, we were stuck. And again, Bob Zemeckis was incredibly helpful to us because he could see the dilemma we were in. We didn't have another movie to immediately take all the CGI department across to at that point. And we were certainly developing films, but we were going to have a 3 or 4 month gap where we couldn't pay anybody's wages. So Bob was doing contact with Jodie Foster. So he said, do you think you guys are up to doing this contact scene I've got in this film, this wormhole scene where this character goes down a cosmic wormhole. And I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I looked at it and he said, look, Peter, I'll let you guys do the wormhole scene, so long as you keep an eye on it and sort of to be a second unit director for me. I mean, Bob shot the plates of Jodie Foster and everything, but he was in LA. We were in New Zealand still, and so we took on the wormhole scene, which was really just very, very kind of Bob, because that enabled us to keep our crew employed just long enough for the next film to come up.
I'm sorry, because you probably had to tell this story more times than you care to, but just can you explain how in that moment when you're thinking about what do we do next, you and Fran, I believe you're considering a variety of fantasy ideas and sort of seeking something like The Lord of the Rings. And then I guess it's just sort of like, why not do The Lord of the Rings? But then I guess it's really a question of if you would be willing to connect the dots, just because it's now a legendary Hollywood story, how you guys go from that thought to Harvey Weinstein to Saul Zantz to Bob Shea, if you wouldn't mind.
Yep, I can do that. It wasn't Lord of the Rings at all that was going to follow The Frighteners. It was King Kong. So during that patch where we'd finished The Frighteners, it was you know, it hadn't been released yet, but Bob had saved our necks by giving us contact, a sequence from Contact to do. We were talking to Universal about a remake of King Kong, which, you know, for my history with that movie, I couldn't think of anything better to do. You know, in the sense that would be my ultimate dream to do King Kong. So we started working on King Kong, and you know, people came back on the payroll, and a certain amount of pre-production money got spent. And then The Frighteners came out, which was not great box office, pretty disappointing box office. And suddenly, you know, it was a classic example of how I was, while The Frighteners was unreleased, I had a certain amount of heat. And so Universal were you know, starting to finance pre-production on Kong. And then when The Frighteners came out and it didn't do particularly well at the box office, suddenly I don't have heat anymore. That was a real lesson. And they, I mean, what the official story was, which is sort of it's not untrue, is that they had also Mighty Joe Young, another big ape movie, had been greenlit already and was being made, and Universal were looking at a King Kong versus Mighty Joe Young release, and there had been Volcano pictures competing and all of that sort of stuff. So they certainly went cold on King Kong, and we had. We were thinking about what to do after King Kong. We'd actually written a script of King Kong at that point too, and so we had been thinking about a fantasy film, like a Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts style fantasy film. And we had a first look deal with Miramax as a result of Heavenly Creatures. So they bought Miramax. Was not involved in the production of Heavenly Creatures. It was $2.5 million, and the New Zealand Film Commission. I think we got a German company to co-finance it. So Miramax simply picked it up as a negative pickup deal. But on the basis of doing that, they got some kind of first look deal with Fran and I, which didn't include King Kong because that had already started, but it was going to be whatever happened next. So we started to think, Fran and I were thinking about a fantasy film, because I was thinking, you know, it was, apart from me loving fantasy, it was also, what can we use all these computers for? We've now got, 40 people, 40 computers to have to look after. Otherwise, if we lose them, they're going to, you know, and they had skilled up quite well on The Frighteners. They were doing good work, you know, largely untrained. And so we knew that we'd lose them, and we'd have the computers, but we wouldn't have the expertise to use them anymore. So we really didn't want to lose our crew. And Fran and I were talking, and we could do a fantasy film. No one's ever done a fantasy film like The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad for a long time. You know, not very well anyway. So that's where we were thinking. And then we kept talking about ideas, and Fran kept coming up with stuff, and I'd say, isn't this a bit too much like The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit? And then she said, yeah, you're right. And then I'd come up with an idea, and she'd say, wasn't this a bit like The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, isn't it? And so after 2 or 3 weeks of this, we thought, well, shouldn't we just find out who's got the rights to The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit? I mean, we had no clue. I was expecting it would be, you know, George Lucas or Steven Spielberg or somebody would have had these rights tied up for decades. But we asked, we went to our manager, Ken Cammons, and we said to Ken, could you just find out who owns the Tolkien, the rights to Hobbit and Lord of the Rings? And our thought was to do The Hobbit first as a standalone movie. We knew that Lord of the Rings could never be one movie, but it could probably be two. So we thought we're looking at three pictures. The Hobbit, make The Hobbit first, release The Hobbit first, and if it's successful, then you go into a two, you shoot the Lord of the Rings back to back, but only if The Hobbit is successful. And so anyway, King came back and said, you're not going to, he said, the rights are owned by Saul Zahnz. But he says, but forget about it. So many filmmakers have approached Saul over the years to do a Tolkien film. I think John Borman had recently done a script, and I mean, obviously the Ralph Bakshi one had been done, and there was other filmmakers had been trying to get. So Saul Zahnz had a constant hammering at his door, and he just sort of seemed to have the policy of saying no to everybody that banged on his door. So we had our first look deal at Miramax, and on some phone call with Harvey, because we were just staying in New Zealand the whole time during all this. And so we had some phone call with Harvey about the, you know, what we might do next. And we talked about The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, but I said, oh, look, but they're owned by this guy called Saul Zahnz, and he's not going to part with them. And Harvey said, I'll get them up, Saul. Oh, Saul owes me a huge favour. And again, the timing was lucky for us, because this phone call between us and Harvey Weinstein took place about 2 or 3 weeks after Harvey had bailed Saul Zahnz out of The English Patient. Fox was doing The English Patient, and Fox had dropped the film, and then Harvey had swooped in and given Saul the finance to make it. And then we have this conversation with Harvey. So 2 or 3 weeks after Saul gives Harvey the money to do The English Patient, Harvey makes a phone call to get the quid pro quo. Saul, you've got to give me a chance at the rights of the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings. And then very quickly it became, we couldn't do The Hobbit because The Hobbit was co-owned by United Artists, and still is to this day. And it was all going to be too hard. Harvey said, no, it's all too hard. Let's just jump straight into Lord of the Rings. And then that, and that became two, it was two films. This was now, you know, it was, Bob Z had done two films with the Back to the Future 2 and 3. I don't know how many other times it happened, but anyway, we were looking at doing the Lord of the Rings as two films back to back. Miramax had just been bought by Disney, and apparently they had like a $30 million expenditure cap on each film before Disney had to give their approval. You know, they had to make a special approach to Disney, and I don't know what the truth of all this is. I only heard what I heard, but apparently they went to Disney, and Disney said, you know, because the budget was something like 150, 180 million for the two Lord of the Rings films. And Disney declined to increase the Miramax cap on the spending. They didn't want to go there, and quite frankly, I don't blame them. With that, you know, because it was me, the Frighteners hadn't done well, so who would ever be paying that sort of money? So Harvey got angry with Disney, and he said, "Stuff him up. Let's just keep on going and develop it, and something will come along." So we spent about $20 million of pre-production, which wasn't squandered money. It was a lot of the film had been designed. Miniatures had been made, armor had been made. You know, there was a lot of tangible things to show for that $20 million. But however, it was clear that Harvey couldn't get any more money. And so he said, look, I can get Disney to give us $70 million for one film. And I said, okay, so you're saying we're going to shoot one film, we're going to shoot part one of The Lord of the Rings and release it, and then if it's successful, we'll shoot part two. He says, no, one film only, it's a $70 million budget, and you've got to do the whole thing in one film, and that's what's going to happen. And And he gave us a 7-page treatment, which I don't think I've ever shown anyone, about the Miramax way of reducing the Lord of the Rings down to a 2-hour film. It's hilarious. So when they go into the, so, well, I mean, one of my favourite sequences in the Fellowship of the Ring are the Mines of Moria sequence, where the Fellowship goes into the mines under a mountain and they encounter the Balrog, you know, the big fire monster, and Gandalf gets killed and he falls off the bridge and all that. I mean, that's about a 25-minute sequence, which I'm really proud of. I'm still proud of it. And but the Miramax version of doing the Mines of Moria was that they you cut to them approaching the mines, you then cut to them sitting around a fire afterwards, you know, a campfire, saying, "Gosh, those mines were really scary, weren't they?" "Yes. Did you see that huge big monster that, oh no, and Gandalf got killed? That's terrible." So the Miramax way of reducing this down to one film was that, and I've still got the 6 or 7 pages where they had laid it all out. And I said to them, "Look, we just can't do that." I said, this is, look, it's, you know, there's sure there's a huge number of people in the world that have never read this book. For sure, but there is also a lot of people that have, and you're guaranteeing that everybody that has read this book, and it was, I think, the most best-selling book outside the Bible, I think at that time. I said, you're guaranteed of making something that's going to disappoint everyone that's read this book. Why would you do that? I mean, sure, there's people that have never read the book, that don't have a clue, and you can pull the wool over their eyes, but anyone that's read this book is just going to look at this movie and say, what the hell were they thinking? And so Harvey said, "Well, you've got to do it, or I'm going to get John Madden to direct it, and I'll get Hassan Amani to write the script, and you guys can just go."
Was there something once about Tarantino too, or was that did he ever bring up Tarantino?
No. Not in my mind. Now, look, I'm sure a lot of conversations happened that we weren't in the room for, but not in my mind. But yeah. Knowing Quentin, he'd never do it in a million years anyway. But he had John Madden and Hussein Amani, and again, I've never spoken to those guys. I'm using their names in the sense that Harvey used their names. They may not have a clue of about any of this. And so we just said to Harvey, "No, we can't do it. We can't get involved in something that's going to just be so obviously disappointing to people." And we had the pressure on us of all these people at Weta to have to pay for, and it was our golden ticket out to say yes to Harvey would have meant we had them on salary for another 2 or 3 years while we were making this film, but we just couldn't do it. So we said no, and we walked away from it, and we were officially walked away for about 48 hours. But Ken Cammons, who deserves a huge amount of credit, Ken, who represents us, he was angry, and he was angry with Harvey, and there was a lot of other stuff going on that was, and he went to Harvey he didn't talk about it with us. We sort of had mentally made the cut. We, Fran and I, had to decide not to do it. And at that point, you don't sort of ooh and ah. You just say, okay, it's done, it's finished. And we were beginning to think of what we might do next. Bad Taste 2 was looking pretty good. But Ken went to Harvey and said, "Look, these guys have killed themselves for 2 years writing the script. You can't just treat them like this." And so Harvey then gave Ken an impossible So Ken said to Harvey something along the lines of, "You've got to let them have this in turnaround for a period. Give them a shot at setting it up somewhere else. You want to make one film, they want to make two. At least give them a shot at doing that." So Harvey put a bunch of conditions on it. It was we had 1 or 2 weeks. Yeah, the clock was ticking. 1 or 2 weeks, we had to get somebody who would make two movies, because obviously he was offering to make one, so we couldn't just find a studio that would do one Lord of the Rings film. We had to find a studio that would do two Lord of the Rings films. And he and Bob would get 5% of the gross of whoever made these films, whoever financed them, had to give away 5% of the gross to Harvey and Bob Weinstein. So we came to LA at that point. We had a lot of photographs of all the models. As I say, the $20 million pre-production had actually got a lot of stuff made, so I was able to, at least I was able to shoot a showreel of all the stuff. So we came and we pitched it to just about everybody in town. Everybody in town passed. I mean, we literally got notes. We got no thank yous from virtually everybody. Apart from New Line, and New Line was the last meeting we took. Because no, we sort of you look at the list of what your meetings are, and there was only six or seven really. Polygram was one. Polygram were very enthusiastic, but they were being sold to some working type. I don't know. They were, I forget now, but they were in the process of being sold, and they said, "Well, we'd love to do it, but we've got to get through the sales process." And I said, "Well, how long is it going to take?" Oh, about 4 or 5 months. And you know, Harvey had given us this 14-day window. And he said, "Well, that's not going to work." So it wasn't like there was people that were unenthusiastic, but it was just not going to pan out. So New Line were on the bottom of the list because we just didn't think for a million years that New Line would be interested in this. And so we went to New Line for our last meeting, having been turned down by everybody else. And Bob Shea, I knew Bob Shea slightly, very, very slightly. And we arrived for the meeting. Mark Odesky, who worked at New Line at the time, he took me to one side and he said, "Look, you know, because I had a 20-minute show reel. It was a 20-minute reel I'd made with all the masks and the miniatures and the armor, and just trying to sort of give people a sense of what it would be like." He said, "Look, Bob's agreed to watch your show reel, but don't be alarmed if he just gets up halfway through, doesn't say a word, and walks out, because that's what Bob does." And so then we're all sitting there in this conference room with a TV and it was a VHS tape in those days sitting there, and then there's a word that Bob Shea wants me to go to his office. And so I go to his office, and Bob Shea gives me this whole lecture. You know, he was very sweet, very, very nice. So he gave me a lecture saying, "Listen, Peter, you know, we've liked the films you've made. We'd love to work with you. You know, I don't think we're going to be doing this film." So he was basically letting me down softly before he'd even seen a frame of this 20-minute film. He's saying, "Look, I don't think this is going to be the one that we're going to work on together, but I've agreed to watch it because I have respect for you. But, you know, it's really not the sort of thing that we do. So let's go and watch it." And when I went back in the conference room, Fran was sitting down there, and I just with my eyes, I just signaled her. I said, "No, this is don't even have hope. This is a waste of time." Because Bob had already effectively told me he wasn't going to do it before he'd even seen it. And then so we sat there, and I was waiting for Bob to get up and walk out. It was the most agonizing 20 minutes because we had music and Tim score, and we just sat there quietly watching this thing, and I could see the back of Bob's head expecting any second for him to stand up and leave. And he didn't. He sat there the whole time, and then it's almost become a thing of myth now, but it's true. He was going to say the first words. We were just completely quiet when the thing finished. We weren't going to say a thing, and he said, "So just tell me. I don't understand that sentence at all." And I'm thinking, "Yeah, God Christ, you don't understand it." He said, "I just don't understand why when it's three books, why are you only doing two films?" And that literally was code. That was what he said, and that was code. You know, you'd have to be in the room to get the subtext of it all, but that was code for the fact that he's saying New Line are interested in doing three films. You know, and from that point on, we'd written two scripts. We'd written a part one and a part two script, so we had to throw those out, rush back to New Zealand, and as fast as we could write three screenplays, which was actually much, much easier because you do have the three books: The Return of the King, Two Towers, and Fellowship of the Ring. Sorry, Fellowship of the Ring, Return of the King, and the two. No, God, I'm getting Fellowship of the Ring, Two Towers, and Return of the King. Good.
Well, it's been a few years.
I won the trivia prize. So you do have three books, and it's always easier to write a script based on a book rather than having to get halfway through the second book and then stop. You know. So
well, thank God that was his reaction, and not only that, but that you guys could do it in New Zealand, which was important to you. That you could do all three at once, which was sort of unheard of, out of sequence, all three. Because I guess really the idea is if the first one comes out and had flopped, you weren't going to get to do the other two. So this was the way to do it, right? And then just so people know the scale of what you achieved, I think people have the idea, but just very quickly, I'm going to just say, and correct me if any of this is wrong, 15 months of shooting spanning October 99 to December 2000, 274 shooting days, 22 speaking roles, 23,000 extras and crew, 48,000 props, 350 sets, 100 plus locations, 21 cameras, as many as 7 units shooting simultaneously, 4.5 million feet of film. Weta's staff grows from 30 to 250 during the production. It's just incredible. And the other thing that I think people may not realize, VFX were obviously so central to this with Gollum and other things, but also you were doing incredible things that sort of harkened back to your childhood with more practical effects. I mean, the shooting of the forced perspective, all of that. And I mean, we all know what happened with the films, but I guess I just as a last quick thing about that film before we enter the home stretch, I mean, can you in hindsight believe I must have taken you a few years to process what ordeal that was, to the extent that I think you said I'm never going to do anything like this again before you sort of got roped into the Hobbit when Guillermo fell out. But I mean, it must have taken years off your life in a sense, right? Before adding them back on with all the success.
Well, it was 274 days of principal photography. I'll always remember that figure, 274 days of shooting to do all three. One aspect of it that never really gets talked about, but was, again, in hindsight, it was helpful, is that, I mean, we were shooting in New Zealand and New Line was based over in LA. Mark Odesky was our point person from New Line, and Mark was fantastic. He you know, really kind of helped keep the wolf from the door and acted as, you know, very much as a go-between the filmmaker and the studio. But one of the things that was happening during that period that people have forgotten about is that I'm always grateful to the fact that there was a period in time, maybe for 2 years, where New Line were owned by Time Warner, and Time Warner was being sold. I don't know if you remember all that. It was
sure.
It was like Jerry Levin was part of Time, and there was Ted Turner around. I can't remember it all now, but and it was a lot of media attention was on the sale of Time Warner, or the splitting up, the dividing of Time Warner into Time and Warner, you know, it was one of those sort of big corporate moments, which went on for months and months and months. And I always credit that with actually giving us freedom, because it felt like to us like New Line was so consumed, because it was all because Time Warner, how that sort of division and how that restructure of that conglomerate ended up was actually going to dictate whether New Line survived or not. And so it was both good and bad. Is that one? I think they were so focused. The New Line and Warner Brothers people were so focused on the political behind the scenes stuff that was going on at the time that we sort of flew under the radar a wee bit, which I think in hindsight I was very grateful for. But also it also meant that every article that got written around that time while we were in principal photography before anyone had seen anything was all about how, you know, what's going to happen to New Line once the Time Warner split occurs, you know, New Line. And then it would talk about New Line. Then it would talk about how the folly of this Lord of the Rings film that they've entered into. They're making three films at once, and how stupid is that? And it's a crazy last minute roll of the dice to try to save their skins. I mean, it was, I'm not quoting anything exactly, but it was like we had freedom in New Zealand to make this film because their attention was elsewhere. But all the articles that were being written, probably some in the Hollywood Report,
before my time.
Before your time, okay. But all the articles that were being written couldn't help but tie us into the possible demise of New Line. Well, clearly, once this Lord of the Rings thing is a huge failure, New Line aren't going to survive. And so it was all this. Da, da, da. So we had this freedom, but we also had this doom-laden commentary for years. It went on and on and on and on. But that was good, because I'm the sort of guy, and a lot of our crew and Fran and everyone, is that if people say, you know, you're going to fail, then it makes you all the more determined. You give it that extra 10% or 15%. You really dig deep to prove these people wrong. So I'm actually grateful to the fact that we were the subject of a lot of doomsaying, you know, because in my mind, looking back, that made us really so determined to make.
Well, and we'll just note that the only two movies at the time that Return of the King was released, the only two movies that ever grossed more than $1 billion worldwide, were both movies that people projected to fail, Titanic and your movie. And so, and then of course, Return of the King ties the number of record number of 11 Oscars and all of that. But, I guess since then you've really focused and rightly so been able to do the things that were most important to you in the sense of King Kong. You get to realize that childhood dream. And I know you've said some of those scenes with New York in the city towards the end are some of the things you're proudest of having done. There's The Hobbit, which again, something you'd wanted to do that gets realized. They Shall Not Grow, this amazing ability of sort of reviving World War One, which in its own way kind of led or prepared you for Beatles Get Back, right? I mean, here you have excavated the past, brought it back to life in a way that, you know, restoring footage and making people look at things differently that they thought they knew. Can you connect how, I guess, They Shall Not Grow comes out in 2018, Beatles Get Back is 2022, but it really started with, Beatles Get Back starts with outreach from Apple about something completely unrelated, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was an only child, but the person that I'd met in my life who was the closest to a brother to me was Andrew Leslie, who was a DP on the Lord of the Rings films and then Kong and the Hobbit films and stuff. And after the Hobbit had been finished, Andrew died suddenly. He had a heart attack and died, and that was a huge loss for me. Because he, you know, and I had no stomach really to make another film with a different DP. It's just kind of weird. I just didn't want to. And so when the Imperial War Museum came along and said, "Are you interested in using our First World War film archive and doing something special for the 100th anniversary of the First World War?" I said, "Sure." And the First World War has been a topic because my grandfather fought in the First World War, and so I've always been interested in that. So I said, "Sure." I was in London looking at World War One footage at the museum, and I went. Apple asked to see me. Apple Corps, the Beatles, Apple, because they had heard. I must have done an interview at the time with somebody. They'd heard that I was interested in AR, not so much VR, but AR. I thought that was at the time. You know, that was very, very exciting. It still hasn't quite got there yet. But back in 2015 or 16, it felt like it was hitting there. And internally, Apple had been talking about some Beatles museum exhibition, live exhibition thing that they thought that AR might be useful for that, and they didn't know anything about it. So they heard I was in town looking at museum footage, so they asked me to come in and just talk to them about AR. It was just Jeff Jones and Jonathan Clyde from Apple. And so being a long-term Beatles fan, I was you know, happy to chat to them about it. I had an iPad and I had some of the restored footage from They Shall Not Grow Old, which they were very impressed by. And I said, "Look, if you've got old Beatles footage that you want us to restore, you know, we can do that," because they've obviously, you know, that's all they really have is the archive to look after, and they've got. And then I said at the meeting, I said, "Well, what, have you got all the outtakes from a Let It Be?" Because I knew that there was a lot of film shot, and I knew it was way, way more than ever got seen, but I had no idea if it survived. Because, like, you know, the outtakes from A Hard Day's Night don't survive. The outtakes from Help don't survive. You know, it's not unusual for the outtakes just to be thrown away at the time. And they said, "Yeah, we've got every single outtake. We've got 60 hours of film and 140 hours of audio." And I was thinking about using, they could use the, I mean, it wasn't even me really, it was just me advising them, thinking you could use some of those outtakes for the AR, the museum things somehow, because at least it was a bunch of footage that has never been seen. Because otherwise, when you think of the Beatles, you know, when you shut your eyes, you're thinking of Shea Stadium or the Ed Sullivan Show or the press conferences, you know, or Help, A Hard Day's Night. It's just a limited. And the fact that there's a whole, you know, as soon as they said it, they've got all this footage. But they said, "Well, we don't know whether we'd want to use it for the museum thing, because we're thinking of doing we're thinking of making some kind of a film using the outtakes." And this is also coinciding with, I think they were in their last few weeks of post-production on eight Days a Week, Ron Howard's film. So they were clearly in the mind of thinking, what are we going to do next as the Beatles? You know, what are we going to do next? And so that conversation just led on to the idea that I'd have a go at doing something with with the outtakes. And that suited me because, again, I was in no hurry to go back to finding another DP to work with. So I got to work with footage that a DP had shot 100 years ago on They Shall Not Grow Old. I got to work with footage that a DP had shot 50 years earlier for The Get Back.
And just amazing. Like, if somebody hasn't seen it, the stuff, it's magic. Like, you see the song Get Back coming out of nowhere. You see George quitting briefly. But I think the thing that you've said, and I find it the most interesting, is that even the Beatles, the surviving Beatles, Paul and Ringo, and they had this misconception that was the end of things. That was where it all went wrong. It was a disastrous time. You were not interested in making a documentary about the Beatles breaking up, and this is not that.
No. Well, after that first meeting in London, when I just described, I was supposed to fly back to New Zealand with my World War I footage to carry on working on They Shall Not Grow Old. But I extended the trip for a week, and I said to Apple, "Look, this isn't really," because they were starting to talk to me about if you were making this film, what would you make it about? And I said, "Well, I need to see the footage. I mean, the first thing I need to do, because I don't want to make a breakup film." So, and I was thinking, I wasn't saying it. I was thinking, God, if Let It Be, the movie Let It Be was what they allowed people to see in 1970. What is it that they held back from people? How awful is this footage going to be? Is what I was. That was what was in my head. So I wasn't really wanting to see it particularly because I love the Beatles and I didn't want to see them arguing with each other and fighting and all that sort of stuff. Didn't make me happy in the slightest. But anyway, I said to them, look, why don't I just extend my trip for a week? I'll come in every morning at 8 o'clock in the morning into the conference room, TV, video, and I'll just start watching it from day one, shot number one. Let's just screen it in exact order that it was shot in, one day at a time. And so in that week, I only got to day three and a half. But that alone, those first 3 days made me, I was laughing so much. And I could see that George was getting very annoyed sometimes with what was happening. I could see, I could sort of see the dynamic on those first 3 or 4 days. I could see there's this comfort at being at Twickenham Film Studios, because Twickenham was never a place that they were going to record music. It was rehearsal space. They were literally there to rehearse. And Michael Lindsay-Hogg had two cameras and was filming them. So the audio was being captured by the Nagras that the film crew had. It's not being captured on 8-track tape or 4-track tape. And so I could see how awkward that was. I was sort of analyzing, watching them, but they were basically, they were okay. It became much, much more enjoyable for them when they went to Savile Row, which was like day 12, I think that is the first day at Savile Row. Yeah. And all the way through me watching it, Jonathan, and then eventually I had to go back to New Zealand. So Apple kindly bundled it all up on some sort of discs for me so I could quietly watch the remainder of it when I got back home. And they kept saying to me, well, what's the film about? What's the film about? Which is a perfectly reasonable comment. And I just said, well, let me see it. And then when I watched it all the way through, Jabez Olsen, who I've edited with for years, I really wanted him to see it. And I was also happy to see it again. So then I sat down and watched it all through again with Jabez. And it just became obvious to us that, the story is just the story as they experience it. They set out to do something on the 2nd of January 1969. They ended up on the rooftop at Savile Row on the 30th of January. And what happens in between, just day by day, just tell the story as they experience it. So that immediately, gave us the concept that we're not going to have any modern day interviews. We're not going to have anybody talking from today who is remembering back to that time. Because one, as you say, the memories are not that great. And after 50 years, who can blame anybody? But also, we didn't want, I was so determined, having spent 40 years as a Beatle fan, reading a lot of crap about this period in very prestigious Beatle books, I was so determined not to feed that fire anymore, and I just wanted to simply tell the story as it was. And so to tell it as it was, I wanted the only people talking to be the Beatles in January 69. I didn't want Ringo and Paul talking now. I didn't want Jim to be Michael or Glenn Johns or anybody now. I just wanted the 1969 Beatles to tell us this, to experience as it's happening with them. And that was interesting because once you take away the safety stop of having a narration or having a modern day interviewer who can plug up the holes in a story, it really makes you listen to every line that somebody's saying, because anything that anybody says at any time could be a really valuable thing to fill in a hole in the storytelling. So we spent, so Jabez and I spent months sort of eavesdropping on 1969 conversations. And because the story is as much in the audio tapes as it is in the footage. I mean, you know, basically there were two cameras and each camera had a Nagra sound recorder and the sound tapes. The sound tapes last for about 16 minutes and they're not hugely expensive. You know, the rolls of 16 mil film last for 10 minutes and it's a lot more expensive than sound. And so the sound recorders tended to just, you know, run the roll of sound out, load up the next roll, press record and go. And so the actual story of the Let It Be sessions is pretty almost intact on those sound tapes. And then the film crew with no coordination between the sound recorders and them, the film crew would just turn on the cameras on and off at certain times. So you'd get, so the sound recorders would be recording for 7 minutes, 8 minutes, and then 8.5 minutes, the camera would flick on, it would be on for 17 seconds and then it's off and the sound just kept carrying on. So it's like, you know, the sound became the real Bible for us, the Nagra tapes.
Well, it's just the most incredible achievement because even though it's not, I mean, people see this and they see, I guess, three episodes of basically two or so hours, but it's really, I think, 22 short films in a way. I mean, each day, it feels like that must just, what a challenge. And to listen to some of it, I wonder what it was like for Paul and Ringo to hear Paul saying 50 years ago, won't it be hilarious if in 50 years people are saying the Beatles broke up because Yoko was on an amp or something? Like, it's just crazy. But
when we first heard that, because we heard it for the first time, and that was 2019. So it was, so exactly. 50 years to the dot.
Oh,
it was really, it was a spooky thing to hear, I have to say. But you know, and I've also felt that a lot of Beatle accounts of the Beatles, not all by any stretch, but a lot of books that are written about them and everything, there seems to be a need to somehow favour one Beatle over another, or take sides, or do this or that. And I just thought, well, these are four guys who have got the same things that they're dealing with that we do. They're dealing with relationships. They're trying to be creative. They're trying, you know, they're dealing with pressure, with deadlines, with friendships. And I just thought that these, I mean, I'm not going to impose a story. I mean, those 30 days that they, you know, well, that was 22 days of actual filming and recording. Those 22 days contain all the drama you need. You don't have to set one. You don't have to set John against Paul or anything else. You just, you know. So I was absolutely determined not to do that. Just to be completely neutral and just to show it as it occurred.
Well, with our last minute, I hope I can do something where I just ask you for a sentence or two of what comes to mind about a few quick random things. To begin with, I wonder, where have you most observed the influence of The Lord of the Rings in the 20 years since the first one dropped, 21 years? I wonder if, you know, is it a Game of Thrones? Is it, where do you most see the impact and the influence?
Well, it's more for other people to say than me. The first time I became aware of the fact that another filmmaker might have seen The Lord of the Rings was when I saw Kingdom of Heaven, which Orlando was in. So I was interested in seeing that because Orly was in it. And it was one of the first big films he made after he finished Return of the King. And so, and when I saw Kingdom of Heaven, I started to recognize, not, you know, I'm not recognizing shots or anything. No, nobody stole anything, but I just started to see that maybe the battle scenes I'd done had inspired other filmmakers to do similar sort of shots. Because, you know, because I guess the thing that we pioneered on Lord of the Rings, which hadn't happened before, were the battles with tens of thousands of people. Usually in the 50s or 60s or 70s, you were making a big epic film. You'd shoot it in Yugoslavia or Spain. The government would give you 2,000 soldiers to dress up in Roman togas or something. And 2,000 soldiers looks pretty good on screen. But battles that have 10, 20, 30,000 people, that could only be done with CGI. And so to me, that was, if there's anything that we gave to the ongoing continuity of filmmaking, was the fact that we were able to open up the CGI bag of tricks to have huge battle scenes. Yeah.
Next one, 2 weeks from tonight will be the premiere of a new version of The Lord of the Rings on Amazon. Apparently it costs almost $500 million. You've been in that moment before something comes out where people were saying this is crazy. What do you make of the idea of somebody spending almost $500 million on a Lord of the Rings TV series? Is there going to be an audience for that?
I'll be watching it. So there'll be at least one person. No. I mean, I look. They asked me if I wanted to be involved in it right up the front, and I said, to them, it's an impossible question to answer without seeing a script, because you know they were doing the scripts, wasn't it? Wasn't going to be us. And so they said, oh well, as soon as we get the first couple of scripts, we'll send them to you to look at. And the scripts never showed up. It was the last thing I heard, which is fine. I mean, I went on to do they Shall Not Grow Old and Get Back. I've got no complaints at all. I mean, I'm not the sort of guy that wishes ill will on anybody. Filmmaking's hard enough, and if somebody makes a good film or a good TV show, it's a cause to celebrate. So, you know, the one thing that I am looking forward to is actually seeing it as a perfectly neutral viewer, because I always felt when we did the Lord of the Rings movies that I was the unlucky person who never got to see them as a coming out of the blue type film. I by the time they were screening, I was immersed in it for five or 6 years. I it was such a loss for me not to be able to experience them like everyone else was, that I actually did seriously consider going to hypnotherapy guy and to hypnotize me to make me forget about the films and forget about the work I'd done over the last six or seven years, so at least I could sit and enjoy them like a audience. I never followed through with it, but I did talk to Darren O'Brien about that, because he thought he could do it, but
Well, you anticipate though the next question, which is, I was curious, how recently have you gone and watched those films and watch, you know, watching your work of years ago, are you able to sort of step back and say, wow, look what I did?
I don't tend to watch my own movies that much. I mean, I more so They Shall Not Grow Old and Get Back, because I don't consider those to be quite, I didn't go through the trenches, which is maybe not the best analogy for They Shall Not Grow Old, but I don't, you know, I was working with other people's material, and Michael Lindsay Hogg shot amazing stuff, which he should get huge credit for Get Back. So I'm happy to look at that stuff anytime, but the feature films, I finish them and I don't revisit them. Lord of the Rings movies we watched before we made The Hobbit, so that's probably back in 2009. Maybe I watched the Lord of the Rings films the last time I saw it. We had a Christmas about 3 or 4 years ago, and Kate Winslet came down to New Zealand with her family to spend Christmas with us, and we talked, and both Kate and I realised we hadn't seen Heavenly Creatures for, I think it was 23 years, 24 years. And I said, oh, I don't want to see it. And she said, no, I haven't want to see it. And then we said, well, should we just watch it ourselves tonight? So Kate and I sat in the lounge, and we put it on, and we that was the first time I'd seen Heavenly Creatures. That was sitting with Kate after about 22 years.
And what was that like?
She could remember everything. She could remember the next line she was going to say. She could remember, oh, that was the day that we did this. And I mean, to me, I half of it was was a blur, which was actually quite fun. Quite fun to watch one of your own movies after you've forgotten most of it, which, you know, 20, 25 years, it's a long time. So, but she, I mean, her mind's like a steel trap. She was giving me a running commentary on what was going to happen next. I was going, yes, Gay, I know. It's right. Just calm down.
Well, here's the last one for you. An article that I read prepping for this noted, quote, "The Return of the King would be the last time, at least to date, that the Academy would heap all its laurels on the biggest movie of the year," close quote. Now, the gap between the taste of the public and the taste of the Academy have never been wider. And I'm not saying one side is right and one side, or, you know, which side is right, but that does seem to be the fact. And I wonder, in your view, is that a problem? Is there something that should be done about that? What does that say?
Well, isn't that, and again, I'm only just speculating, isn't that connected to the streaming, really, there was no streaming when Return of the King came out. So it's, and I'm not saying streaming would have affected Return of the King, but it affects that mid-range, take Return of the King out of it, but if you go back to Tootsie and Ordinary People and all those films that used to win Oscars, they were all the mid-range films that cinema used to thrive on, and we used to love going to see those films, and they don't really exist in that way anymore. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not really answering your question with any precision, but I kind of think the industry has changed so much, not necessarily for the better. Now the whole thing is, if you're going to give the Oscar to a big, successful box office sort of movie, then it's likely to be a Marvel film. And do people give Oscars to Marvel films? That's the dilemma that everyone's thinking about. It's just like, I don't know. It should just be about work, good work, well done, that your peers celebrate good work, regardless of where it comes from. But the story of the Oscars not awarding their awards to the most successful or popular films, but giving them to smaller films, has almost become a story itself. It almost feeds itself, you know, and I don't think that's particularly healthy either. It becomes very self-conscious. You know.
Would Lord of the Rings even be something that could get made today, as a film, as three films?
Probably not. Not with a director like me, with a studio that put its money on the line for three movies. I don't think so. No, I doubt it. I very much doubt it. I mean, you know, I look at the Lord of the Rings TV series where Jeff Bezos has put all that money into the series. That's sort of, in a way, that's, I mean, it's a different circumstances, and it's a, but that's, you know, that is a company bidding the farm to some degree on Tolkien. So it's sort of, you know, it's connected to what we did, but in a different form, of course.
Well, I can't thank you enough for all the hours of entertainment. Thank you for the time doing this, and can't wait to see what you do next. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thanks so much, Scott. Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. Until next time, thanks for joining us.